I'm Kathy, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, it's an honor to be here and be part of this archives thing. And the thing I want to do first is thank Megan for asking me to speak tonight. I never refuse an AA request. That's old school, you know. Someone in AA asked me to do something, I do it. Ann can't hear me. Can you hear me now?
No.
Testing. Anyway, only once in my whole life did somebody call me from AA and ask for help, and I didn't go. And I had just come in from a 12-hour flight, and I had just gone to bed, and I just could not get myself out of bed. And that was, I don't know, over 30 years ago. So I do what I'm asked here because I owe so much here. When we're pulling up in the driveway, I saw Harry pulling in, and Paul says, well, there's Harry. And I said, oh, Harry came. And I said, Harry's heard my story before. And Paul said to me, Kathy, it's about the food. Get your ego in check. So, you know, that kind of right-sized me. But anyway, I'm Irish, Catholic, from Boston. I come from a family of 10 children, and I'm the only alcoholic. Though my father and his mother were both alcoholics. My father was a periodic alcoholic, and sometimes he only drank once or twice a year. But my mother tells me it was always memorable. So till I was about 30 years old, I used to tie my Christmas tree, tether it to the wall. And someone said to me one day, what are you doing that for? And I said, well, doesn't everyone do that? And she said, no. So I said, my mother always did it. So I asked my mother about it. And she said, that's because your father always knocked down the Christmas tree at Christmas. So anyway, I just let the thing stand up by itself now. But my mother came from a family of 7 children, and none of them are alcoholic. Yet every one of them married alcoholics. So that's kind of interesting. So there's a lot of isms going on in there, I think. The first time that I drank, I was about 14 years old, and I'm from Boston, so it's cold. It's cold in Boston in the winter. So I'm from the city, so we would hang out like in hallways and stuff, and that's where people would drink and do all that. So I drank and got drunk. The first time I ever drank, I got rip-roaring drunk, and I barely remember going home. And the next morning, my mother came in to wake me up, and what had happened that night, and I do remember this part, I don't know if this ever happened to you, but I was laying on the bed, and the room was spinning, 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 and then I would throw up, and then the room would spin and spin. And so my mother walked in, and she said, this place smells like a brewery. Have you been drinking? And I'm like, no. So she thought she would punish me and do something that would make me not want to do that again. So anyway, she made me clean the whole house that day. And the truth was that something happened to me when I ingested alcohol, and I had a personality change. And I became comfortable within my own skin. And ultimately what happened is that's the way I always would for many, many years be comfortable, because I didn't know how to be social. I always wondered what was the right thing to do, the right thing to say. I just was afraid of everyone. But not when I had a couple of drinks. Once I had a couple of drinks and I relaxed, it was normal for me. Now, I didn't drink every day either, you know, like my father. I would like to have drank every day, but I couldn't function. I was just one of those people, you know, like Paul, he drank every single day and went to work every day, but I wasn't like that. I had to, thank you, Scooter. good, because I could hear the feedback. But I couldn't function, and I had to go to work. You know, I was always a good worker. I never had a problem going to work. I had a problem with a lot of other things, but work wasn't one of them. So anyway, at around every weekend, I would get drunk, and I do vaguely remember thinking, there should be life between Monday and Friday, because I really only lived for Friday so that I could enjoy my life. So anyway, I met a singer in a band, and he was everything that was glamorous to me. In hindsight, he really wasn't all that glamorous, but he looked pretty glamorous to me at the time. And so my mother liked him, and so I married him. And so we went off traveling all over the country with this band, and I got pregnant on my honeymoon, so I had a child right away. And I could drink, once I got away from home and got away from my mother and all of that, I could really drink the way I wanted to. And you know, guys in bands, they drink a lot. And so, but it was really, it was a blast, you know. I really had a lot of fun with that. And then we had this little baby and was schlepping all over the United States with this baby. And we moved to California in the late 60s. And my mother had already moved out there, and she lived there. And that's when I really, really, really got full-blown into my alcoholism. And not only did I, you know, it was the 60s. I was hanging around on Sunset Strip, you know. It was just amazing. And I lived with my mother at this point, so I had a built-in babysitter, so that was pretty nice, too. Anyway, I didn't have much of a capacity for alcohol, which was really kind of a bummer because, you know, alcoholics like to drink a lot. So, but then out in Southern California, I learned how to live through modern chemistry. And I took care of that problem so that I could drink a lot. And I could drink all weekend if I wanted to. While I was in California, a couple of things happened. One time I lived in San Pedro for a while, and I was driving, and I was pretty stoned. I mean, and I had the music jacked up, and I'm driving, and finally I look, and I see the blue lights in my mirror, and I'm like, oh, crap, and I was all alone. And so the cop pulled me over, and he was screaming at me, I've been following you for 17 blocks. And I'm like, I didn't see you. I didn't hear you. I was busy in here, you know. So anyway, he took me to the police station. And back in those days, they didn't have all the tests. I mean, and I was more stoned than I was drunk this particular night. So there weren't any tests for that. So by the time I get to the police station, I'm like sobering up or coming down or whatever you want to call it. And the sergeant says, I can't hold her on anything. She's not drunk. She's fine. You have to take her back to her car. I want to tell you, that cop was so pissed. But he drove me back to my car. But then fast forward a little, you know, a few more years of drinking, and this husband moved back to Boston, and I stayed in California. And where's Ed? Ed, where are you? There you are. One of my stories I love to tell because I think it's funny, but I don't think it's funny. What I think it does is depict alcoholism perfectly for me. I was in this bar in Belmont Shore called Kelly's, and I was telling my story one time, and Ed heard it, and he came up to me afterwards, and he's been in that bar a lot. And so it was Kelly's bar, and it was St. Patrick's Day. I had to be there, right? Where else would I be? So I had gone out, and I bought this really nice suit, you know, really nice green suit. And I'm in this bar, and I lose my people. I can't find them. There's just so many people. And I had gone to the ladies' room, and I made a couple of friends in there. And so we were sitting in there talking and sharing our goodies, you know. And so I don't know how long I was in there, but when I come out, I couldn't find my friends. So being the astute alcoholic that I am, I thought, I'm going to sit right by the front door, and if they try to leave, they'll see me. So I sit there, and this guy comes up finally, and he says, what are you doing? I said, I'm trying to find my friends. And he said, you want a drink? So I said, sure. So we sat there, and he helped me look for my friends sitting there. And we had a couple of drinks, and finally, you know, a few hours went by, I guess, I don't know. And he says, do you want me to give you a ride home? You're not going to find them tonight. So I said, okay, give me a ride home. So we're out driving around, and around, and he's like, where do you live? And I'm like, I'm trying. And he was really aggravating me. You know, I was doing the best I could here. So anyway, finally, he has to stop to go to the bathroom. And I'm sitting in his car, and I'm aggravated. Who does he think he's talking to? So I showed him. I drove away in his brand new yellow Corvette. Unfortunately, I was too drunk to drive very good. So I went over a curb, and the police stopped me. And the police said, whose car is this? Well, I don't know. So I don't even know the guy's name, let alone his last name or where he lives or any of that stuff. So anyway, the police take me to jail. I know. See, it's funny now. So the police take me to jail, and I'm starting to sober up a little because now I'm scared. This is getting serious. I'm on my way to jail. But I think they're going to know that when they see this nice green suit, that I'm not just a common alcoholic. So they took me to jail and never mentioned the suit and locked me up. And the next morning, they said I could leave. And they said to me, you could have left 4 hours ago, but we couldn't wake you up. So I go outside, and the sun is shining, and I'm so humiliated. And I think, oh, my God, if anybody ever sees me, I'll just die. So I get in a cab, and I go home, and because I don't have a car. And they towed his car, that nice little yellow Corvette. But I did wake up with the music thing. He ended up with no radio knob. But anyway, I get in the cab, and I go home, and I say to myself, I am never, ever, ever going to do this again, because it's humiliating. I don't know if anybody here has ever had a DUI or have ever been to jail. You don't have to raise your hands or anything. But, you know, it's pretty humiliating. So anyway, I get home and I close all the shades and I'm never going to go out again, and my phone rings. And one of the guys, one of my friends that I was looking for last night, said, what happened to you last night? And I said, oh, I just left, which was true. And he said, well, we're down the bar. You want to come join us? What do you think I did? You know, I mean, what sane person, after all of that and all those horrible feelings and all of that embarrassment, and lucky I didn't get arrested for car theft or something like that. I never heard from him again. Thank God. He was a good guy, I guess. But anyway, I went right to the bar and got drunk again. And, you know, it just kept just happening and happening and happening. And then my last drunk, I had a roommate, and I was living in Marina Del Rey. And her company was putting on this big to-do, this big boondoggle down in Rancho Bernardo, down around San Diego. And she didn't have a boyfriend, so she asked me if I wanted to go. So I said, yeah. And but now here's the thing. This, my little helper that helped me drink a lot more, I didn't have any of. So I went everywhere trying to get some, because if I didn't have my little helper, I could only drink 3 or 4 drinks and I was wasted. So I looked everywhere and I couldn't find it. And, you know, I'm kind of I am a singleness of purpose, but I'm gonna mention a drug. I could only get mescaline, you know, and so I had to have something, right? I know, what's a girl to do? So anyway, I thought, well, maybe it's a little speedy. Maybe it'll bounce me up there a little. So I get down to Rancho Bernardo, and I'm taking this, and I'm having a few drinks. And the first night was okay, but the next night, we walk into this dining room, and there's all the tables, like these round tables, and there's linen and beautiful everything. And there's 3 different kinds of wine on each table. And I look at the wine and I think, Kathy, don't drink that. Because if you do, you know you'll get drunk. And when you do, you know you're going to humiliate yourself. So anyway, this little voice in the back of my head said, so you'll drink slow, you know? Well, the next morning when I woke up, because I didn't really remember much, I do remember my roommate saying to me, "Will you stop hitting on the owner of my company?" And I said, "He likes me." You know, I'm sure he did. I was very attractive. I was pretty wasted by this time. But I'm sure he was just crazy about me. But anyway, I wake up the next morning, and she's there, and she looks at me with such disgust. And all I can think is I got all defensive, and I'm like, "Hey, you drink just as bad as I do. You know, don't judge me." However, once again, so humiliated. And I mean, I have so many stories I could tell you, you know, but we've all got them. But this one was like, I really couldn't take it anymore, you know. So I got in my car. They all went, and they were going to play tennis, and they were going horseback riding and doing all this stuff. And I just snuck away, because I didn't want to see any people from the night before, because I really didn't know how much I'd embarrassed myself. I do know one thing, but I'm not going to tell you here, but if any of the girls want to know later, I'll tell you. But anyway, anyway, I drive back to L.A., and I get halfway, and I'm so hungover, you know, and I'm sick. And so I stop, and I get a strawberry daiquiri. And that even sounds disgusting now on a hangover, doesn't it? A strawberry daiquiri? No, no accounting for taste, Harry. But anyway, I drank this, and that was my last drink. And so I get back to L.A., and I had this really good friend, kind of really good friend, and he was a drug counselor. I hung around with him a lot, so I happened to know he was also a drug addict, but it didn't apparently bother his counseling. But anyway, you know, back in the day, you didn't have all this stuff, you know, so they took anybody, I guess. But anyway, I called up and I said, you know, I said to him, I said, "You know, I think I really need some help. You know, do you think it's okay to ask for help?" And he said, "Yeah, in fact, I think you should." You know, there's kind of a snobbery about people that do certain drugs and people who drink and the people who think they're better than you because they do this drug and then you drink and you're sloppy. You know, that's what he thought. I was just a sloppy drunk and he was a cool drug addict. But anyway, so I went and I called AA. And the lady answered the phone and she said, "Do you think you have a problem with alcohol?" And I said yes. If she had asked me if I was an alcoholic, I would have hung up, because I didn't even think about whether I was an alcoholic or not. All I thought is, man, I need some help. I got a problem here and I don't know what to do. So she asked me where I lived and I told her, and then she named several meetings around me. And because I was such a big shot, I had to wait until I heard just the right address, which was an acceptable place where I could go to a meeting, because I just wasn't going to a meeting anywhere. So I go to this meeting in Brentwood, because that was a good address. And I walk in and there's like 300 people there. You know, the meetings are huge in California, at least they used to be. So I walk in and I promptly get my first resentment, because I walk over and there's keys everywhere. That's what people do. They would come in and they would put their keys on a chair. Then they'd go get their coffee and they'd socialize. So I just picked the keys up and moved them. And I sat there. And so this lady come over who with not a very good attitude, talking to a newcomer, I want you to know. And she said, "You took my seat." And I said, "Your seat? You know, how does it get to be your seat?" So anyway, she said, "I had my keys on there," and I don't know what that means. So anyway, I thought, you know what, you know? And you know what? I don't carry resentment, but I got to tell you, she's still not my favorite person. So anyway, so what? You know, 37 years ago, I'm still, you know, I'm kidding. So anyway, there was a lady speaking, and she had the most incredible personality. And everyone was laughing, and she was talking about she was this party animal. And I thought, I'm a party animal, you know? So what? I sit in my house now every night and drink all by myself. I still know how to party. So I thought that I was a party animal, and I related to her. But one thing she said that I didn't relate to is she said she was sober for 5 years. And I'm like, 5 years? It was so inconceivable to me, I thought, she's got to be lying. Because how could anyone be sober for 5 years? And I don't know why I would think she would get up there and lie in front of 300 people, but I did. So anyway, everybody in California, you raise your hand for 30 days. They say, are there any other alcoholics in the room? And you raise your hand, and then they say, is there anyone in their first 30 days? And so for the first 30 days, you stand up and you raise your hand, and it's really good because people really get to know you. And in every meeting, people come up and they talk to you. So that's what happened to me. You know, people just started giving me their phone numbers. And I met this one girl, and she took my phone number. And she said, I'll call you tomorrow. And she also gave me her phone number, but I waited all day the next day for her to call me. And I waited and I waited and I waited. For whatever reason, I couldn't pick up that phone and call her, but she called me. She finally called me and she said, I'm going to go to a meeting tonight. Do you want to go? And I said, yeah. So I met her at the meeting, and then I'm at this meeting and my neighbor walks in. And I'm like, oh my God, my neighbor, right? So he walks over and he says to me, I didn't know you had a problem with alcohol. Real nice. And I looked at him real sarcastically and said, I didn't know you had a problem with alcohol. You know, I got real defensive. So anyway, he was my neighbor, and he had 4 months at the time. And he went to a lot of meetings. So every night he would call me. You want to go to a meeting? I'm going to Manhattan Beach. You want to go to a meeting? I'm going to Belmont Shore. You want to go to a meeting? I'm going to Long Beach. And I was just too afraid to say no. I did not want to go. I didn't want to go to any of those meetings. And, I mean, you know, I've been in some pretty tacky bars in my day. But we went down to Manhattan Beach, and they swore at that meeting. They used foul language, those people. And I thought, I'm just a little too good for this. So anyway, you know, in retrospect, it's kind of funny. Like, I never heard that language before. I heard a story about this girl I sponsored. Her son was in jail most of his life, you know, till he was about 30. And he got a job, and on the job, they were swearing. And so he quit. I'm like, really? You've been in prison for 15 years. They don't swear there? So anyway, so this girl that called me took me to some meetings, and she became my sponsor briefly. But I didn't trust her. You know, I didn't trust anyone, but I especially didn't trust her, and I wasn't comfortable with her. And she was doing some things that weren't really very nice, you know. And I won't go into all of that, but I knew that she wasn't going to be a good fit for me. So my next sponsor, her sponsor, was having a 13-year birthday party. And they asked me if I wanted to go to this birthday party. Well, I was real curious as to what you all do at a party if you don't drink. So I went to the party, and I was just so afraid of everyone. I was just terrified of everyone. And I sat on the floor with my feet under the coffee table, and this real pretty lady comes over, and she sits beside me, and she says, you know, you can leave if you want to. And I was like, I can? And she said, yes. And she says, as a matter of fact, if you want, I'll walk you to the door. So I was just so grateful, because I really wanted out of there, because I had no idea what to talk to you about or what you were talking about. I didn't know what to say. So what do you say? So you're an alcoholic? How long have you been sober? You know, how many meetings do you go to? You know what I mean? I just didn't know what to say. So her and I, that was Rochelle. That was my real first sponsor. And her and I started talking and started going to a lot of meetings together. And Rochelle had a wonderful sense of humor. I mean, she really did. And I have to preface this, because sometimes when I tell this story, people think she was mean, but she wasn't. What she was saying was, get over yourself. Don't take everything so seriously. Lighten up. And the ways in which she would do this really do sound kind of mean. But on my first year of sobriety, my brain was so scrambled that I couldn't... I don't want to hear anything from Paul, because I still don't have a great sense of direction. But I couldn't find myself, my way, a lot of places. And every time I would go to her house, I'd call her and I'd say, okay, now how do you get to your house again? And I would see her once or twice a week, and I could never find my way to her house. So she's giving me my first year chip, and when we finish, she says, She says, you know, she says, I didn't know if you had brain damage, permanent brain damage, or if you were just incredibly stupid. So I'm like, yeah, thanks. You know, I know it sounds mean, doesn't it? She said worse things. But but anyway, she took me under her wing and took me everywhere with her. You know, and I remember now I've got about 4 months sobriety, and I'm walking behind her, and I hear her say to somebody, oh, yeah, that's Kathy. That's my little people pleaser. Oh, I want to kill her. How dare her talk about it? And then not only that, at 4 months, she called me a newcomer. She said, yeah, that's my newcomer, my little people pleaser. So one other thing happened in that first year, too, that really was good for me. But I'm in a meeting, and I don't know, I have 3 or 4 months sober, and this girl gives me a note, and she says, I'm 7 months sober, and I'm still crazy. Call anytime. And so I'm like, I'm not going to call you. You're 7 months. That was so long. How could you still be crazy? After 7 months? So anyway, Rochelle, you know, the first birthday party, she threw that birthday party for me. And because I was so afraid of people, I didn't talk to anyone. And I went to predominantly speaker meetings in California, which there was a lot of them in those days. I don't know if there are now. So she threw this birthday party for me. And I only knew a handful of people, which were her friends. So, but then, fast forward to 5 years later, I had another birthday party. Someone else threw a birthday party for me, and everyone was my friends, you know. And so I use that as kind of a benchmark of how you change. Now, going into my second year of sobriety, I don't know about the rest of you, but I was pretty mad. I mean, when they say I could feel my blood boil, I knew exactly what they were talking about. When they said alcoholics don't get angry, alcoholics have rage. I knew exactly what they were talking about. And it was so painful, you know, all that anger going on in your head was so horrible that I really thought I would go crazy. So I told my sponsor, I've got to do something about all this anger, and because I'm going to go crazy. And so she says, well, go talk to Eli, because Eli went crazy, and he can help you. So that's how it works around here, right? So I go to Eli, and Eli says, yeah, I did. I went crazy. I ended up in the asylum. And so I said, okay. So he said, but you don't have to. And I said, what do you mean I don't have to? He said, you don't have to. And I guess I took that as, you know, all right, I'm not going to go crazy. But I was on my way into a meeting to meet my sponsor one night, and I was pulling up in front of this Vicente, San Vicente Boulevard, and I'm going to pull in and park, just going to a meeting, meeting my sponsor. And this little old lady zooms right in and takes my parking space. And I'm angry. I am very, very angry. So I park up the street, and then I run as fast as I can because I don't want her to get away. So I run up to her, and I'm not going to cuss, but you can fill in the blanks. I looked at her, and I said, you took my parking space. And she's like this, you know. So I walk into the meeting, and I said to my sponsor, I may have just overreacted. So, anyway, then fast forward again, 5 years sober, another parking space incident, and I go to pull in, and this lady takes my parking space. So she wasn't as old and as feeble, so I got her quick. So anyway, she walked in to get her nails done, and I walked in behind her. And her eyes got that big and everything, and I just, because I called her the B word. That's what it was. In the parking lot, I called her the B word. So I walked in behind her, because now I'm 5 years sober, and I know better. Okay, I know it's not okay to act this way. So I walk in, and I say to her, I had no right to talk to you like that, and I apologize for calling you that. And I turned around, and I walked out, because somehow that anger had dissipated, and I didn't even know when it went away. You know, all of a sudden, I just didn't feel all that anger anymore. Now, when I got sober, they told me that we were pretty much asleep mentally until somewhere around 3 to 5 years. And then we wake up. I mean, we really wake up. I'm sorry, Ramona. But anyway, by waking up, what I was taught is that you become aware of somebody other than yourself. You know, it isn't all about me. It was always all about me. And anything that had anything to do with you was all about me. And so all of a sudden, other people started to matter. They started to become important. How you felt, what you thought, what was going on in your life. You know, it wasn't all about how I felt, what I thought, what was going on in my life. And it was wonderful. It was just wonderful to realize that and to be aware of that. There was a lady also at that time, and this was, I meant to say this a few minutes earlier, but it's important for my sobriety. There was a lady who had 11 years sobriety, and I knew her from my first 7 years of sobriety, and she was in and out, in and out, in and out. She could never get it again. And that was a real good example for me that I didn't want to go out, because what if I didn't get it again? What if I didn't come back? You know, and I say that to people all the time today, you know, because we say, yeah, the door swings both ways. And yes, it does. And I always knew I had another drunk in me, but I don't know if I had another recovery. And I don't want to take that chance. And I think also, just because someone comes in and out, in and out, in and out, doesn't mean that every single time they're going to be able to get back. Because I'm here to tell you, I've seen a lot of people die here. And I've seen a lot of people go out and never come back. So anyway, I go to work for this company. I changed jobs. By the way, I had a really great job. I had a beautiful home overlooking the ocean. I had a new sports car. My kid was in private school, and I spent my life in my bedroom every weekend drinking. So it doesn't matter whether you're under the bridge or you're looking out at the water, what's going on inside is going on inside. And one of my first sponsees, her family owns a big drugstore chain, and she shared with me early on that they drove her to school in a chauffeured limo every day, and she was so humiliated that she would make the chauffeur drop her off a block or so down the street so the kids in school couldn't see her. And so what I realized, it's the same thing. It's the same thing I was feeling inside. It doesn't matter, like I said, whether you're being driven to school in a limo or whether you're living under the bridge. That lack of self-worth and that horrible inability to do anything is just, it's innate. So, and the other thing is, let me get transferred now to Boston, because I've got a lot of sobriety from then on too. I go back to Boston, and I do not like the people in Boston. Now, this is my hometown, but it wasn't my first 7 years of sobriety and my people and all the people that knew me and how you did things. Well, compared to California, everything's wonderful. Boston's very stoic. You know, they don't even hold hands when they say the Lord's Prayer. But, I still think that's kind of weird. But so this friend of mine in California, I kept calling him, and I kept saying, do you know what they do in Boston? And he would say, well, tell me, Kathy, are they staying sober in Boston? And so I'd call him a few days later, and I'd like, do you know what they're doing in Boston? And he'd say, tell me, Kathy, are they staying sober in Boston? So stop calling him, right? I mean, he was no help. So anyway, then what they do in Boston is kind of interesting. They go on commitments. And a meeting like your meeting, they would have a bookie. And the bookie, I know, it's not the bookie in the sense we know, it's really a booking agent. And he would go like to Hillside, and he would invite all the people from Hillside to come and speak at your meeting, and everyone would do like a 10-minute pitch. And so you don't hear the same people all the time. You hear new people all the time. And then you have the fellowship going to the meeting. You know, you have the meeting before the meeting, and then the meeting, and then coming home from the meeting when you go have ice cream. Because no matter if it's freezing in Boston, everybody goes for ice cream. So I grew to love that. You know, I just really loved it. And then I met Paul. And Paul liked the ice cream, let me tell you. But but anyway, we were at a dance, and my BFF was sitting beside me. And this is, you know what? This is, I don't care what you think. Anyway, this is, Paul was new, okay? And I had 7 years of sobriety. And so I turned around, I looked at my girlfriend. Don't look at me like that, Ed. And I looked at my girlfriend, and I said, do you think he's new? And she looked at me and said, very. So anyway, I said, all right, he's off grounds. But we liked each other, you know, so we started a friendship, and we would go skiing together, because I was new back in Boston, too, and he was newly sober, so he hadn't done a lot of the things that he really liked to do, like skiing and traveling and things like that. So we did this as friends, and I must have been friends, because I had to pay my own way. So that means friends, right? So anyway, little by little, you know, he starts calling, and we're talking late at night. And anyway, long story short, we ended up getting married, and Paul was like just under 2 years sober. And it was frightening for me to do that. You know, I don't know how frightening he was. He was frightening. I don't know how frightened he was, I mean. For me, I thought, oh, my God, this guy's going to get 5 years sober, and he's going to wake up and say, oh, my God, what did I do, you know? And so I was in therapy at the time, and I asked my therapist, I said, do you think this guy's capable of loving me, you know, like he says he does? And she said, he's every bit as capable as you are. So I'm not real quick to do things as a rule, but that first husband, the singer in the band, we broke up, and I never got divorced because I was afraid of marriage. You know, I thought, my God, this isn't good. I hated it, you know. So we were separated. They used to say it's because I'm Catholic, but we were separated for 17 years. And but I had a plan. And my plan was, I said, I just don't want to be so spontaneous and rush right in and marry someone else. So if I stay married and I meet somebody, and then I get a divorce, it'll take a long time for the divorce to be final, and in that period of time, I'll know whether I really want to marry him. I mean, that makes perfect sense to me. So, before we got too serious, even, I went and filed for divorce. You know, I just said to my sponsor, I said, this is not just any guy. This is not just any guy. This is someone real special. And so I didn't even tell him I was getting divorced. He probably would have run for the hills if he had known, but I didn't tell him. So anyway, that turned out to be a wonderful thing for me. Yesterday, Paul and I celebrated 28 years of sobriety. I mean, marriage. So, and you know, Paul's a Bostonian to his core. And a guy came up to him and said, who had two divorces under his belt. And he said to Paul, you're too new in this program. You shouldn't be marrying her. And Paul's about a year and a half sober now. And Paul just looked at him and said, who the asked you? You know, he's nice like that. So anyway, we got married. And then Paul worked for the T, and he only had 7 years to go for full retirement. And I was offered another promotion. That's how I ended up in Boston, with a promotion. And so this was a real big promotion. And so I wanted it very, very badly. But how do you ask your husband to give up when he's got 7 years to go? So I said, you know what? I can't make this decision. I'm afraid to make this decision. I don't want you to blame me later for something. So you make this decision. And he really hated his job. And so Paul said, you know what, Kathy? In 7 years, I could be dead. Let's go. Let's go. Let's have an adventure. So we did. The company transferred us to Colorado. And we had a great time there. I mean, the people in Colorado were really nice. And I had a meeting in my house. They still call it Kathy's meeting. The meeting's still going. But so then there was a position open in Georgia. And so I asked for a transfer, and we ended up in Georgia. And now we've been here for 25 years and have many, many friends and a lot of life has happened since we've been here. You know, that daughter turned out that she did a lot of pills. and she was in and out of the program, and she tried. You know, I'll tell you, when I see people in here that have been in and out and in and out, all I think is, oh my God, thank God you're here. Please stay. Just please stay, because if you go, you don't know. You know, like at one point she had 3 years of sobriety, and then another time she, shortly, she died. She died. Shortly before she died, I had gone out to California to give her a first year chip. And then when I went to give her the second year chip, I knew she was loaded when I was giving her the chip, and I didn't care. Who cares? You know, like Paul always says, like, you know, some drunk comes up and takes a chip. Who cares? It's a chip. They're here. So what I learned was, you know how we talk about unconditional love around here? Well, I really learned unconditional love, because I loved her whether she was clean or whether she was loaded, and I was there for her, and it didn't matter. And her and I were joined at the hip. We always have been. And one of the things that she said to me before she died, and this is a tough one for me, she says, Mama, I've loved you every minute of my life, you know, and she did, you know, and but she had two children, and she was unable to take care of those children, thank you, and so Paul and I adopted those children, and we adopted them and raised them as our own, and before my daughter died, we had many conversations and much gratitude about us doing that. You know, she said, Mom, she said, I couldn't. I have been unable to take care of them, and thank you so much for doing that. And those kids are now 23, and Amanda will be 25 in September. And as we speak, Alex is in detox. And he was in detox a couple of weeks ago and escaped. I mean, he escaped. He ran out. So I guess he had enough of that. But anyway, he's, you know, I thought I'd lost him, you know. He would still come over for holidays and stuff like that, but I could always see that he was drinking or drugging or whatever, mostly drinking. But he's a wonderful person. He's just a wonderful person. And he's never seen Paul or I drink, and I know we brought him up with good values, and he's oblivious, though. They had a 30-year party for me at my house, remember? And Alex says, you're in AA? I mean, really? Are you kidding me? And so so anyway, I'm like, yeah. It was 7 years ago, so we'll give him a little. But anyway, you know, we went up to Dalton today. He put himself back in detox. He called 911, and I have high hopes for him. You know, I don't think, you know, it's painful to see the struggle so close, but it's the way it is. It's the struggle. You know, it's the disease wanting to pull us out there and pull us out there. It's just giving me goosebumps. And us trying to say, no, I don't want to do that anymore, you know. And sometimes the disease wins, and sometimes it wins only temporarily, and sometimes it wins permanently. So I have high hopes for Alex that, you know, he called me today, and he sounds wonderful. And so keep me in your prayers, everyone, please. And Amanda, she's a joy. You know, she wakes up and dances in the morning. That used to drive Alex crazy. He's not a morning person. But, you know, she loves us so much, and she makes us such a huge part of her life. And she's moved back to Georgia. She's going to go to nursing school here. And she's got these two little kids. And they're just, one of them is named after me, Riley Kathleen. And so, you know, I get to make a difference today, you know. And maybe I was 3 to 5 years sober before I even realized that you existed or you mattered or that you were important. But I've always been involved in AA. I've always been of service, and I've always sponsored people. And to even be able to do that is such a gift. And I want to tell you, the people that I sponsor give me so much. You know, it's not that, that I'm giving anything to them. And I've learned so much about myself through the people that I sponsor. You know, and we're so similar. You know, we're all so similar. We may have little different stories, but the disease and where it takes us and how it takes us, it's all the same. So, and my sponsor is Helen from Central Office. Somebody was just telling me, Kelly, that some people have a little hard time with Helen. But Helen appears to be this genteel Southern belle. Well, she's not. She's a steel magnolia. And she talks to me a little bit like that first sponsor. You know, one day I was telling her, I was telling her about this family member and their character defects. And so Helen says to me, well, that is a character defect that she has that you don't. And I'm like, yeah, I don't. And so then she looked at me and she said, but perhaps you have some character defects that she doesn't. You know. So she talks like that. And so I kind of think sometimes that I'm getting hit upside the head, but it's so subtle. You can't be sure. You know, it's just like, wait a minute, what did she just say to me? So anyway, today Paul and I are both retired, and we travel a lot. You know, we don't even work, and we took 5 vacations last year. So we're about to go off to Russia and do some things, and just we're having a great life. And that doesn't mean, you know, that stuff doesn't happen. A lot has happened. You know, I had a grandbaby that died, and I didn't drink. I had a daughter that died, and I didn't drink. I have a son that's in and out of detox, and I'm not going to drink. So what I know is, you know that expression, I don't hear it very much, don't drink even if your ass falls off? Well, don't, because it'll pass. It always passes. And somebody, I thought it was Paula, but somebody gave me a chip on my 30th that said, now I've been through damn near everything, you know, and I have, you know, but what I know is that you don't have to drink over it. And is life difficult sometimes? Yeah, but it's also fabulous and joyous and wonderful, you know. If it's as simple as a sunrise, or, I mean, I feel really, oh, there's so much I didn't tell you about the steps and my relationship with God and all that, but maybe next time. But anyway, I wouldn't have this life if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous and you people in these rooms, because I didn't know who I was. I listened to you, and that's why I mean also that we're so much alike. I listened to you, and so I found me, you know, and in these rooms I found God. And I want to thank you very, very much.